All right, well, good morning to everybody. Welcome to the first telebrief of 2021. As hard as it is to believe that we've got 2020 in our rearview mirror, so let's all hope that we can be safe and healthy and a little more normal in 2021. There is plenty to talk about this morning, as always. The first thing I wanted to do was to let you know that the Department of Labor has been very active, both on New Year's Eve and even this morning. As I always tell you in these telebriefs, things happen up to the last minute. And just this morning, the Department of Labor finalized its rule on the definition or the distinction between employees and independent contractors. We talked a little bit about this when they proposed their rule back in September, but now it's been finalized. It'll be published in the Federal Register. And it'll be interesting to see whether the incoming Biden administration seeks to withdraw it. But essentially, what the Department of Labor has done is said that in most cases, there are two main factors to determine whether an individual is an independent contractor or an employee. Those two factors are whether that person has control over his or her own work. That's the first one. And secondly, whether that person has the opportunity for a profit or a loss as a result of personal investment. If those two issues are not determinative, then the Department of Labor says that you go on with looking at three other factors, which include the amount of skill required for the position, the permanence of the working relationship, and how integrated the worker's role is in the organization's overall operation. So just published this morning, probably on the DOL's website, if you're interested in going ahead and taking a better look at that. On New Year's Eve, just last week, the Department of Labor issued two opinion letters, one having to do really as a function of those employees who were remote working today. And this had to do with those employees who may take time out and split their work between work at home during a day, and we're talking about non-exempt employees, obviously, not exempt employees, but split their time between a remote work block and then traveling and doing a personal errand or a personal function, and then going back into their office. And the question before the Department of Labor was whether that block in between the remote work and then reporting in or clocking in at their physical workspace would be deemed to be work time for non-exempt employees. The Department of Labor answered that in the negative. So whether it involved an employee who left physical workspace and, let's say, went to a doctor's appointment and then went back home and clocked in from home, the Department of Labor indicates that this is not like the employee in prior days who would go from one work site to another work site where all that time would be compensable. Instead, the Department of Labor indicates that where there's that interruption between the remote workspace and the actual workspace for a personal errand or personal function, that time would be deemed to be non-compensable for the non-exempt employee. On the same date, New Year's Eve, that the Department of Labor put that out, the Department of Labor also issued an opinion letter having to do with electronic posting of required notices. So all of you, I'm sure, have those multiple notices on one poster board in your cafeterias or break rooms or whatever that includes posters under the FMLA, the FLSA, et cetera. But now with remote working, the question before the Department of Labor is, what can an employer do to make sure it complies with those posting requirements? And on New Year's Eve, basically the Department of Labor said that I think the practical guidance is you need to make sure that there is a space on your intranet or your internet or shared workspace that would post those electronically, as well as continuing to post those in a physical space. The only exception to continuing to post in a physical space, according to the Department of Labor, is A, where all of your employees exclusively work remotely. Two, where all your employees customarily receive information from the employer via electronic means. And three, where all your employees have readily accessible access to the electronic posting at all times. The takeaway really is that I think from an employer's perspective, in this era of remote working, you should make sure that employees have easy access to these notices, both on an intranet or a shared workspace or other electronic means, as well as continuing to post them at your physical workspace. So that was New Year's Eve. And then the last Department of Labor issue that they provided guidance on was December the 29th. So I don't know what happened at the Department of Labor or whether they were given bonuses for doing this or not, but it's awfully coincidental that all these came out between December 29th and New Year's Eve. But on December 29th, they put out a guidance on telemedicine and serious health conditions under the Family and Medical Leave Act. Now, those of you who administer or oversee the FMLA issues in your workspace know that an individual employee can take FMLA leave for a serious health condition, which depends upon whether or not the employee got inpatient care, number one, or two, continuing treatment by a healthcare provider. And the department formally defined the term treatment to include examinations to determine if a serious health condition existed or an evaluation of that condition. Well, when the pandemic hit back in the spring, the Department of Labor said that as part of its response, they would consider telemedicine or an examination by telemedicine or a visit by a telemedical visit to satisfy the requirement of a medical exam. Now they've gone ahead and in this still era of remote working, they've indicated that they will consider telemedicine visits to satisfy the requirement for an exam as long as the examination, evaluation, or treatment is done by a healthcare provider, that it's permitted and accepted by a state licensing authority, and that it's generally performed by video conference. So those of you, again, who are responsible for overseeing or evaluating an FMLA application need to know that somebody who has done a telemedicine visit will satisfy those requirements if it's done under those three requirements. Okay, so we'll go from the Department of Labor to the guidance that the EEOC provided on December the 16th regarding mandatory COVID vaccines. And we literally could spend a whole morning, talking about the issues posed by COVID vaccinations. But I want to try and hit some high points or practical, guidance that I see coming down on this. So the first high point to realize is that on December the 16th, the Equal Employment Opportunity guidance indicated that employers can, if they wish, institute mandatory workplace vaccinations as long as the two classifications, which would be exceptions, are upheld. One of those would be whether or not they can accommodate a bona fide disability of an individual employee under the ADA, and secondly, whether they can accommodate a sincerely held religious belief that would militate that a particular employee cannot, in good conscience, under such a religiously held belief, obtain a vaccine. Obviously, this will be the, probably biggest source of guidance as well as potential litigation going into the next 6 months for those employers who are mandating vaccinations. My own view is that I think from an editorial standpoint, you are better off as an employer because there are other obligations that you have in terms of record keeping and questioning of employees. You are better off probably encouraging the use of vaccinations as opposed to mandating vaccinations. So, for instance, if you mandated vaccinations, and for your non-exempt employees, there would be the question of whether or not you are obligated to pay those employees for the time spent in obtaining those vaccinations. And obviously paying for any administrative fees that may be associated with obtaining those vaccinations as well. Even those employers that encourage rather than require the use of vaccinations, I think that you should check with your health insurance carriers to see whether or not if there are any administrative fees. Now, we know the government says that the vaccination itself will be free, but we don't know, for instance, whether if they are given by a third party, that is by Walgreens or CVS or whatever, whether there will be any kind of administrative fees that are associated with it, and therefore check with your insurance, your medical insurance carriers, to see whether or not there would be any kind of a fee associated with that, whether it would be covered. Another issue that would come up, those of you who are contemplating either the mandatory or even encouraging the use of that, is that if you're a unionized employer, those I know some of you out there are, that this is a mandatory subject of bargaining. You would at the very least be obligated to discuss this with your unions and to hopefully obtain agreement or consent on whatever your program would be. If you're going to be encouraging as opposed to mandating, certainly I think that you need to have a good communication campaign in place with your employees to encourage the use of vaccines. And you're going to have good record keeping. And you are permitted to require the employees, even when you are encouraging as opposed to mandating, that they provide proof that they have been so vaccinated, even in the case of encouragement as opposed to mandating. Another question that arises is whether or not you can provide incentives for those employees who would get vaccinated. For instance, providing another couple days of vacation or some other incentive, and the answer to that is yes, you can. And there are a whole myriad, of course, of incentives, arising from this, ranging from payment, whether you wanted to pay each employee $100 for obtaining the vaccine or providing another leave day, et cetera. This is an area that will be fully developed and I'm sure written by employment lawyers in the next 3 months. But just know that, again, from an editorial standpoint, it will be easier to comply with the requirements of any kind of vaccination if you make it voluntary as opposed to mandatory, because if it's mandatory, not only do you have to comply with the disability-related issues and the religious held belief issues, but there are all kinds of questions that have to be limited and record keeping that you would have to keep with regard to mandatory as opposed to voluntary that makes it a little more onerous for you. Now, the interesting question will be, it seems to me, some of you may have vendors or you may have subcontractors where the situation is that you have voluntary programs, but they have mandatory programs. That opens up a whole Pandora's box of what you're going to do under those circumstances, and they will have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. And obviously, I think with the need for employment law advice by a good employment law attorney. So I'm just telling you that as we move further and further into the situation of vaccination and there are more accessibilities of these vaccinations, these issues will come up, some of which have clear answers, some of which don't. And particularly when you get involved in issues of accommodating the employee where you have a mandatory program, you're going to really have to pay close attention or seek the advice of employment counsel. Let me mention, not in conjunction with this, but on December 17th, just a couple weeks ago, the District of Columbia Council passed what I believe to be one of the most onerous bans on non-competes in the country. And under this particular law, which may be able to be passed over a veto from the mayor of the District of Columbia, they not only ban all non-competes, not just non-competes having to do with low-paying wage employees, but all non-competes for any employee who works in the District of Columbia, whether that employee is based in the District of Columbia or not. And I know that many of you have employees that work in the District of Columbia. And the onerous part about this is not only does it prohibit any kind of non-compete for you as an employer, but it also prohibits the employer from restricting the employee from working simultaneously for any other employer while they're employed by you, which to me is just insane. Now, it doesn't prohibit non-solicitation clauses, and it doesn't prohibit confidentiality provisions. But be careful, and I'll get back to you on whether this actually becomes law in the District of Columbia. But to me, it is an insanely onerous provision for those of you who do business in the District of Columbia. On the other side of the coin, the National Labor Relations Board, in a case on December the 10th involving BMW, involving handbook provisions, approved handbook provisions, and this involves BMW again, handbook provisions on non-disparagement, so they gave the okay to those. They gave the okay to prohibitions on offensive language in the workplace. And importantly, because I've faced these situations in the last year, also allowed employers to prohibit any employees from recording of any other employee in the workplace without the employer's permission, and also allowed employers a broad-based confidentiality provision. Now, I caution you, and this is just a general statement, editorial comment from me, take it for what it's worth. It now looks like not only will we have a Democratic presidency, but we'll also, it looks like, have a Democratic Congress and Senate. Although we don't know about Ossoff, but we do know about Warnock, and my guess is that I think it looks like we're going to have both houses Democratic, President Democratic. I think a lot of the liberalization that occurred under the Trump administration, which was deemed to be employer-friendly as opposed to employee-friendly, may suddenly take a turn as being much more employee-friendly during the next 4 years. The roadblock, of course, would be on those cases that reach the Supreme Court, where we have a 6-3 conservative majority, cases certainly that make their way in the employment field could very well meet an unfriendly Supreme Court, unfriendly to employees. But as you all know, there can be a lot done in the administrative agencies by the Department of Labor, by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, by OSHA, by the EEOC, that may pose more practical problems for you all in the next 4 years. So it remains to be seen what will happen, but my, you know, eight ball, my black eight ball tells me that we may be headed into an era where there are many more challenges to the flexibility that may have existed and employer-friendly decisions that may have existed for you all during the Trump administration, whatever you think of him, than there may be under a Biden administration. So stay tuned, and, you know, stay tuned to these telebriefs, and I'll get back to you on those things. So I know I covered a lot of stuff in a short period of time. Kate, can you take this off of mute? And that way, if anybody's got any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Yep, I'll do that right now.
Thanks. Okay. Any questions, comments?
Howard, on the postings for all the state laws, et cetera, now, a number of us now have employees who are working remotely from other states, not just, say, here in Maryland.
Right.
And the posters that we used to put up were all the Maryland laws. But we now have people working in Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania. Do you think we should be posting those state provisions on our websites, our intranet sites also?
Yes. So I think, Ann, the short answer is that if you have employees working remotely, and there are specific state posting requirements, as they're all in every state that we have.
Right.
So, for instance, in Maryland, there is a separate polygraph act. Then I think that you need to post them on your intranet and make sure employees have access to it. I don't think there needs to be a lot of publicity about it, other than a simple statement to employees electronically that anybody who, you know, would like to or needs to have access to any employee notices that are state-specific can go on our site. But the short answer to your question is yes.
Okay. That's what I was thinking. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions?
Yes. My name is Biddy, and I'm with the Children's Youth Alliance. We got an email from one of the companies managing our FMLA. So they are saying that Congress did not extend or amend the FMLA portion. So the leave being covered by FMLA ended as of December 31.
So, well, that's the mandatory leave for both sick leave and the extended family leave did end mandatorily on December 31, but the new act indicates that it's voluntary for employers who want to extend that and get tax breaks into March. So it's up to you as an employer whether you want to extend
yes,
it
Yes, I understand that part, but my question is, does this still count towards the 12-week FMLA or not? Because this email sounds as if it doesn't, so they are saying they are not going to be managing it any longer because it's not covered under the FMLA.
I'm not sure I understood your question. I'm sorry.
So my question is, I understand the part that up to December 31st, 2020, it was mandatory. Now it's no longer mandatory until March. So employers may choose to or to give employees and then get tax credit or not. So my question now is, the new one that has been extended till March, does it still count towards the federal FMLA or not?
Does it still count towards the federal FMLA? You don't get more than 12 weeks in any period of time, if that's your question.
That's what I thought. But this company that is managing FMLA is send an email as if, you know, the new extension does not count towards FMLA?
You don't get more than 12 weeks, one way or another, however you count it, calendar, rolling, or whatever. So I don't know that the new federal law changes any of that. All it is just indicating is that if you want to, as an employer, extend and get a tax break for someone who might be eligible, you can do that.
Yeah, I understand that part.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, well, if not, I hope that everybody has a certainly more normal 2021 and a healthy and a safe one for you, your workforces, and all that. And we will talk in February. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.